The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
From the 37 verses of Togme Zampo, verse 31. If you have not examined your own confusion and mistakes, you might put on a Dharma facade while behaving in a non-dharmic way. Therefore, to continuously examine your delusion and free yourself of it is the practice of a bodhisattva. Well, to borrow the words of the mayor of Paris, welcome back, America. I feel it as a kind of bittersweet, surely a sweet, in terms of how the election went and the possibilities of today and tomorrow, but also bitterness for all that has come before, much of what has come before, and not just in these last 4 years, but Dr. King talked about the debt that had come due a long time ago. The debt of the promise of a true democracy, of a people based in and by and for themselves, of equality. And that at the very beginning, with the declaration of those words, a debt was already due and not being paid. And we are still living that. And we are living it. That's the good thing. Because nothing is fixed, nothing is fixed. Because nothing is predetermined, nothing is predetermined. Because there is only change, there is change. And so all along we've been studying the Bodhisattva as you and I, the Bodhisattva as those enlightened beings in our own spiritual lineage, the vows of the Bodhisattva, the path of the Bodhisattva, the day-to-day life of a bodhisattva, living in a world of confusion and mistakes. The monks, when we shave our heads, we chant in the drifting, wandering world. It is very difficult to cut off, to free ourselves, to release, to liberate our ties, our suffering, our delusion, our anger, our pride, our jealousy. And that's why we chant that every time we shave our heads, to remember, to renew, to reinvigorate. This verse is very interesting to me. In the context of all the others, of all that's come before, of this path of the Bodhisattva that has been so consistently and urgently inviting us in to live the life that we were born to live, in fact, to be the enlightened being we were born as. And hear a kind of cautionary voice. If you have not examined your own confusion and mistakes, you might put on a Dharma facade while behaving in a way that is not in alignment with the Dharma. Therefore, because this is possible, we should continuously examine our delusion and our mistakes and free ourselves of it. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. That as we are striving to be a benefit in the world, that is dependent upon our continued and ongoing examination of ourselves. They hold themselves, they hold each other together. In a sense, they keep each accountable. People around us, our relationships, our obligations hold us accountable, keep us sharp and clear. And we ourselves then can go forth. So this true, bright, formless mind of a student of the way, a student of the Dharma. Master Dogen spoke about it very plainly. To study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self and to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. To study. From the very beginning, the Buddha made it very clear that this is a path to be examined, to be inquired into. And that sense of inquiry, in a sense, needs to be ever-present. Sometimes it's very clear when there's something that is not clear to you, something you want to understand. In koan training, often the koan presents you with a question. It's helping us to know, how do I form this question? What do I direct it towards? What am I trying to understand? Because even though we're in the midst of it, oftentimes we don't know. Right? It's hard to know. Where should I be pointing my attention? What are the aspects of the great matter? And so the koan presents us with that in a clear and explicit question, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes a student encounters a koan and it's like, where's the question in this? Indeed. It's in the student. It has to be in the student. The student has to find their question within that koan. And in that moment, it becomes alive. We've spent so many years, most of us, in positions of being a student in school, year after year after year, class after class, teacher after teacher, studying, being a student of literature, mathematics, history, languages, science, music, art, dance, studying with a teacher, and learning. But what were we learning about being a student? Were we ever taught about how to be a student? It makes me think of all the years when I was in studying as a musician and performing. And my teachers never talked to me about what it means to study performing. How do you perform? The assumption seemed to be, if you learn the piece of music, you will know how to perform it, as though they're the same. And in a sense, yes, but in a sense, no. And so how much time do we spend in school, not just learning a subject, but learning how to learn, how to study? And now in practice, where the subject is yourself, reality, the 10,000 things. I remember my brother, my beloved brother, who in high school, he's a year older than me, and he declared to me one day that we were coming up to final exams, and he had a physics class. And he said, I'm not going to study for the exam. And he was a good student. I said, why not? And he goes, I want to see how much I've actually learned. And I said, but, I think you're studying is sort of bringing it all together and, gathering it up. And so that's part of the learning process. He goes, no, I just want to see how much did I actually learn. Right? Because he was thinking the test is where you just sort of cram it all in just to perform and then... He didn't do as well as he hoped. But I respected him for his experiment. He wanted to see something. He was going to put his own grade on the line. So we learn how we can perform And isn't that what Zanpo's talking about, is we can learn how to perform, how to appear, right? Because we can spend so much time, we talked about this earlier, about, you know, living in our projections of other people, what we think they're thinking of us, what we want them to be thinking of us, and then trying to be that thing. And so we can become very adept at that, but then where are we in that? Where's you? Where's the person? Where's the authenticity? I remember when computers were first coming into sort of use, and going to see my teacher, my flute teacher, for my lesson, and talking about a poster that was on the wall for a flutist that was coming to the school. And I was sort of being very impressed, you know, by this person. And he was sort of looking. I said, "What?" And he said, "You know, they're actually not that accomplished a musician." I said, "But look at the poster." And he said, "Anybody can do that." And I thought, "They can? You mean they could just create that and present themselves as any way they want to, and it's not actually equal to who they are?" It was like, may seem naive to you. Maybe it was naive. But it was something about computers and how now anybody could create a perfection, a perfect presentation of oneself or anything. And the poster seems not to lie. And of course, we can get heavily rewarded for our performances. And not that they're generally, you know, intentionally inauthentic or wholly inauthentic, but so what happens when we come into Dharma practice? There's a saying in the Tibetan tradition that the promise or the vow goes to the Dharma, but the practice goes to selfish clinging. So I make this commitment, I make this vow to practice the Dharma. But then am I practicing that, or am I practicing continuing in various ways my clinging? And so he says we have to analyze our own confusion and mistakes. Right? Because in that, we are meeting our reality. Our delusion, our attachments, our, you know, suffering. And that is one very, very essential aspect of to study the way is to study the self. There is no enlightenment. There is no freedom. There is no progress without that. Who doesn't do this to some degree? Right? Put on some kind of a facade. We all do this. I did this. Maybe there are still ways I'm doing it and I haven't seen yet. If we feel an affinity to the Dharma, we move towards it, we want to practice it, we want to practice with a Sangha, it means we want to be part of this. Somehow we want to fit in. We want to feel like we belong. And that very genuine and good desire can take all kinds of forms, right? And so seeing ourselves, seeing our confusion, our mistakes, it's like, well, that's not going to win the crowd. Wanting to appear serious, wanting to be taken seriously. Who doesn't want to be taken seriously? Shouldn't we be taken seriously? What will lead to our advancement? Right. You know, with on all of our attachments, I think if we look carefully, there's something good in them. There's something that we want that is good and important and of value. And then it just gets shifted a bit through our confusion, through our habits, through our insecurities, our fears. So if we want to be taken seriously, do we take ourselves seriously? And what will that require of us? To face those things that are difficult to face. I remember in the early years, and this is true, I think, probably of most Dharma centers, maybe many things that are coming into formation, but in Dharma centers, I saw, and I was, you know, just a very beginning, you know, little newt of a student. But seeing other people as I came in here to this place and saw other people who had been here before me, and as far as I knew, they were like, you know, next in line to be Buddha. But in fact, they weren't. They were relatively new students. But they had worldly skills. They had some sort of skills that were in great need, right, at the beginning of this, where everything was in demand. There were so many things that needed to be done and people needing to be able to do them. And the challenge of I saw in a couple instances where somebody who had those skills and had a certain amount of, you know, sort of personal mojo, you know, personal maturity, who were sort of picked up, you know, and given a whole lot of energy and attention and a kind of seemingly promise, right, as a person of great potential. And that never worked out. Never worked out. I never saw when that happened to somebody that they stayed. It got all mixed up. And in a sense, it's one of the dangers, particularly in the early years, or challenges for a teacher to not, you know, lose sight of what we're here for, of the students, the teacher's ultimate responsibility to a student, which is to, you know, not put them in service to the center, but put them in service to the Dharma. And sometimes that's hard to resist because there is need. And we think we can manage it. And sometimes it does. And so sometimes people, their life skills, their professional skills are given, invited to be part of and help grow this. And sometimes not, because the sense is that that would be a mixing and a blurring of not just boundaries but identities, to bring that sense of identity and that expertise and mix that in a time when we're really trying to learn how to not know, how to be a student, how to face our vulnerabilities, how to own up to our confusion and mistakes, and to be doing that at the same moment that you're being turned towards as an expert of something. It seems very difficult to do. Why is it so difficult and painful to examine our delusion, our identity? The fact that it is should sort of get our interest, right? It seems like oftentimes we feel the pain of seeing something, but it's like, wait a minute, why is that so painful? Why is that so painful to just see or to just experience? It's like when we're doing anti-racist work, racial justice work, particularly as people who identify as white, and we see into the deep systemic racism within ourselves. We see those aspects of ourselves, and they're so painful that we avoid it. We shut down. We don't engage. We rationalize. We become mute. Why is that seeing that part of myself so painful? That's like a call to attention, a call to, well, investigate that, examine that. There are other things that I see about myself, that we see about ourselves, that are confused, that are mistaken, and we see them, but they don't have that kind of effect, right? So what is it about those particular things that we see about ourselves? Those are the most important, the very important things, because they affect us in that way. That's telling us that there's something karmically in terms of how I see myself, how I want to see myself, and the conflict, the collision that has just taken place between what I want to see about how I want to see myself and likely how I want you to see me, and then what I've actually seen. And it's like, oh, we have a problem here. This is not lining up. And so the idea of letting go of that way of seeing myself or that identity seems untenable, because then what will I be, right? If I let go of that, then I will become that thing that I'm afraid of. And this all goes back to what we were talking about yesterday in terms of what are the consequences, the implications of this sense of self, right? Do we see the connection between the solidification, the sense of something, there is some part of me that is the me of me, that is the treasure house, that holds the essence of me, right? And how I want that to be, how I want that to appear. And when that gets threatened, because that is me, then sirens go off. Who we think we are, who we want to be, who we want others to think of us, ourselves, and all the while we're just stepping into meeting this simple reality. It's just this emotion. It's just this thought. It's just this memory. It's just this action. But we don't let it be just. We turn it into everything. We turn it into me. I turn it into you. And then it becomes unnavigable. Right? What is the suffering? We see something as negative, as unattractive, as hurtful. We have words to describe it, to identify it. We have thoughts and opinions that will judge that. And in the judgment is the verdict and the sentence. And it's usually death. There's a little amnesty here, right? It's usually a very harsh sentence. And so to examine our confusion and mistakes with attention, with joyful effort, as we spoke about yesterday, with ardency, being able to recognize this is not helpful. And I see where this arises. I see how this arises in me. I see its conditioning. That's why in our What Is Whiteness work, it's so important to study history, to understand the story, the true story, the truer story, the more complete story of who we are as a country, as a nation, where we have come from. The more we do that, the more it makes sense. What we see, what we're seeing, all that has been, and what we see within ourselves, it makes sense. And to be able to see that without hatred and scorn, that's the challenge. It's one thing to see it, but we see it without ill will. And that's why bodhicitta is so essential. Why? Because when we raise bodhicitta, what are we raising? The aspiration to see that and to free ourselves. We cannot free ourselves without seeing it. And to do all that we can to see into and alleviate the suffering of others. And so that sort of brings us upright again. It returns us to that place that is true and is workable. It's workable. And so we raise bodhicitta again and again. And when we find ourselves filled with doubt, we raise it again. We examine again. The next verse says, if compelled by your own afflictions, you speak of the faults of other bodhisattvas, you yourself are diminished. Therefore, never to mention the faults of those who have entered the Mahayana path is the practice of a bodhisattva. You know, in studying these verses to see their interrelatedness, right, not just how they're all related to the bodhisattva path in their different aspects, but how they actually tie in with each other. So to just reflect on what is the relationship between studying our own confusion, our own delusion, our own mind, our own worlds within us, and how we can respond to that differently, authentically, not so much, And then how do we speak of others' confusion and mistakes? And this is a very, you know, this is one of those teachings I hope that got your attention. It's like, well, wait a minute. Does this mean that we should never speak out about anyone? Another student, a senior, a teacher, the abbot? Or I will be diminished, I should never mention those faults? And so, how did you examine this verse? Given what you understand about the Dharma, right? How did you examine this? I hope you have asked that question, seen this as potentially problematic, and thought, okay, well, wait a minute. Right? I mean, you could just chuck it and say, okay, I'm just going to erase this out of the text. This one I'm going to ignore. But then you might be losing something important. Right? But to just pass over it or take it literally is also to make a mistake. And so how do we engage it? Well, there are so many teachings that speak about, and I've been talking about how the Dharma is not dogmatic. It is not a rule. We don't practice by rules. We practice by intention. The intention is to free ourselves. And so to not speak against others from a place of hatred and scorn because you want to hurt them. To not speak of others because you want to elevate yourself by putting somebody else down. Because if you speak out about somebody else's faults, you will feel better. Or they have done something to me, and so I speak out because I want to hurt them back. Or I'm struggling, or I've done something that I don't really want you to notice, so I'm going to point your direction to somebody else. Or by speaking about somebody else's faults, I create a subtle sense that I am in such a place that I can do that to create a larger, enhanced sense of myself. Or because I do that because I want to divide. I want to sow the seeds of confusion. And so that is understanding right speech. Those are the reasons why we do not speak in those ways. We examine our own confusion and mistakes. What is my intention? What am I seeking in wanting to speak about this or speak about this person? So from the relative perspective of the precepts of a compassion, the path of compassion, when it's necessary to speak of others' faults, we do. We need to. To not do so would be to violate that precept, would not be compassionate. But we do it for the purpose of helping, of serving. You know, as we get no pleasure from it. From the ultimate perspective, as Master Dogen said in the Kyojo Kaimon, in the midst of the Buddha Dharma, we are the same way. The same Dharma, the same realization, the same practice. Do not talk about others' errors and faults. Do not destroy the way. Understanding that we all have one essence. Even our mistakes have one basic, the same nature as our good acts. And both of these perspectives are true and important. How do we unify those? All beings have one nature. Form is emptiness. Because of karma, actions, conditioning, socialization, experiences, our own decisions, our own responses, they appear differently. Emptiness is form. So we can think in terms of our own country how causes and conditions on a national level led to the election of Barack Obama, our first African-American president. A miracle. Or was that a natural consequence of those causes and conditions? Right? Buddhism doesn't really talk about miracles in that way. It was a result. And in that very moment of that election, 2008, within those causes and conditions that brought it about, there were other causes and conditions that were still present, were very much present, which were in opposition to that event and still present. And so 8 years later, Donald Trump is elected president because of those causes and conditions. But other causes and conditions were still present and active. And so yesterday, Joe Biden was elected president. And so on it goes. And in that, nothing is static. And so what we're calling karmic causes and conditions are in motion. They are moving. They are changing. They are evolving. Are they moving towards a more enlightened, more just, more equitable culture and society? Many of us desperately hope so and are working in our own ways towards that. That's what practice is. We practice and we see change, and we also see old habits and delusions arise again. Old mistakes, old confusions. And so we go back to our cushion, we go back to the teachings, we go back to our vows, we continue. I've seen this in terms of the media. You know, the Washington Post, you know, slogan, I don't know what they call it, democracy dies in darkness. So many things die in when there is no light. Delusion breeds without light when there is no light. And so when we turn that light onto it. And so I was thinking about that in terms of, you know, the role of the media and reporting, for instance, on, you know, the potential for violence and disruption and, you know, in the wake of the election and if it doesn't go well and the need to report on that, because democracy dies in darkness, and in reporting on that, to what degree is that actually bringing that into being? The more it's talked about, the more it becomes that. How do we navigate that? If compelled by your own afflictions, you speak of the faults of other bodhisattvas, you yourself are diminished. Therefore, never to mention the faults of those of others is to have entered the Mahayana path. So if we take that literally, rigidly, as a rule, that could cause and will inevitably cause great harm within a Sangha. And so how do we hold each other in a loving embrace of accountability? So for years, we've had an ethical guidelines that we sort of formalized and formulated and articulated very soon after Dada Roshi's death, 2009-10, worked on it. A lot of work went into it. And then some years later, really initiated by a student who said, you know, these could be made much more clear and useful and usable. A committee of the board began working on them again to revise them and do exactly that, make them more usable, because if they're not usable, they're not, in a sense, they don't exist, they're not functioning. And the beginning of those ethical guidelines reads, a religious training within a Sangha relies upon a profound commitment on the part of both teachers, priests, monastics, seniors, and students to deeply study and realize and actualize the teachings of the Buddha. This requires that each of us, while in training at any center affiliate within the Mountains and Rivers Order, practice in accord with the precepts, the monastery with the Doshinji Code, the rules of conduct for the Kurenji Code at the Zen Center of New York City, In addition, all monastics are expected to practice in accord with their monastic vows. When this is done faithfully, the Sangha dwells together in a way that is mutually supportive, trusting, and peaceful. So that's the Buddha feel that we endeavor to create. And it goes on. These ethical guidelines have been established with the understanding that even in the context of spiritual practice, issues or conflicts based in wealth, sexuality, power, implicit or explicit bias can arise, will arise. And so, guests, provisional students, formal students, senior students, monastics, priests, teachers, each have varying levels of responsibility. We all have a responsibility to the Sangha, to each other, and to the Dharma, and to ourselves, as well as having various administrative and or spiritual authorities within this Sangha. We have different roles, different responsibilities, and those responsibilities touch each other in different ways, have impact and influence on each other in different ways. That's our power, right? If that weren't true, nothing could happen. That's our power, is that we can influence each other in these different ways through all of these different roles and positions and so on. And while each Sangha member is expected to dedicate themselves to their training, to our training, that's our responsibility we have to ourselves, mistakes and transgressions and harmful actions may sometimes occur on the part of the Sangha. From the newest student to the abbot or abbess or head of the order, everybody's included in this. These issues can be destructive forces within a Sangha and thus must be acknowledged, spoken of, given voice, heard, and worked with skillfully through the wisdom of Buddhist teachings and practice. When conflicts or breaches of trust arise, it's essential that there be a pathway through which those involved can effectively and safely address the conflict and work towards its best resolution. The purpose of this code of ethics is to provide that pathway. And so I thought this was a nice way to speak of this in relationship to this verse. And this has been this process of this revision is still in process. We're closing in on it. It's been going on for a while because it's challenging. There's so many different important things to think about, right? And to express clearly. Right? To think about all of the things that have happened, that may happen, that will happen in a way that isn't predictive. We can't make just a list of rules that is going to work in every situation. It has to be clear enough that it's really useful, but also open enough that it can be pliant and flexible and be brought with wisdom to each particular situation, from very small, minor things to very large things. And what that does is it can have a calming effect by just knowing that this is in place, there is a pathway, by acknowledging that this is something we're placing in a high priority. Right? And what we're saying here is we are putting our energy into not concealing, but to bringing out what needs to be brought out in ways that are appropriate. So we must be able to speak of the faults and mistakes of bodhisattvas in certain circumstances. To not do so will diminish ourselves and the Sangha, and in a sense, the Dharma in our minds. And so to maintain harmony in the Sangha must include our moments of disharmony. To practice with integrity has to be able to include our moments of lack of integrity. To practice examining our own confusion requires recognizing moments when we are not examining. How do we walk amidst and intermingle with all of these many things, these various aspects of ourselves, and not put them against each other? As Keizan Zenji said, so it is necessary to ask, it is not necessary to ask about others, to look outside, to wait to be saved. Just look back, he said, just look back on your very first aspiration of mind. Look into yourself and see what is true and what is not true. This is why it is said that it is hard to be as careful at the end as in the beginning. If you really want to be a beginner, a person of the way, if you really are such a person, a student, willing to examine your own confusion and mistakes, willing to take responsibility, then he says, how could you not be a person of the way? You are a person of the way. Master Dogen said, when the Dharma does not fill our body and mind, we think we have enough. When the Dharma fills our body and mind, then we realize something is missing. And this is such an exquisite teaching. And it's easy to understand, in a sense, if there's anything that you've ever really gone deeply into, right, that you wanted to really develop some mastery over. And the more deeply you went into it, what did you find? The bigger it is. The more you accumulate wisdom or knowledge, the more you realize how much you don't know. And in the beginning, that can be very unnerving, right? When we think the point is to know it all, right? To get it all, to accumulate it all. But that's not the mind of a student. The mind of a student ultimately is the mind that loves inquiry and doesn't see it as a threat, doesn't see it as a potential verification of what we don't know. And so we might even be afraid to ask because we don't want to show that we don't know. How many times did I see myself and not see myself in moments where I was afraid to speak, to voice my question because I heard it or saw it as voicing my ignorance? And then the meaning that I gave to that, what does that mean about me? And how I let that, gave that power, until I began to see more and more, I'm just shooting myself in the foot. Right? I'm trying to actually see clearly, and then I am actively working against that. And how wonderful it is in time, as we more and more can sort of be that open, you know, have those moments of just wonder, of having something suddenly become clear to you, and then experiencing that again and again, and wanting more of that, right? As Khyentse Rinpoche said, that's the thing you never want to be satisfied about. Never get your fill of that. And that love for the possibilities. Because the more you see, the more you realize there is more to see. How could that ever stop? How could you ever reach the end of that? And if we could think about that, bring some of that attitude of mind, right? Because we develop urgency in terms of our own suffering because it seems so urgent, because it's our lives that are at stake. But then the joyfulness of that effort. Right? Because really, I think what I realized in moments of despair and insecurity, that I realized, yes, you know, so I'm like, whatever, an idiot or dull or dense or, you know, whatever ways I might have been seeing myself in the moment. And then feeling the weight of that, the burden of that. But then I would think, but I'm here. But I have this path. And in that moment of remembering, I realized, you know, it's okay. I can hold that. Whereas if I didn't have this path, that would be hard. That would be hard. And so if we could think of that in terms of, on a larger scale, like systemic racism, like democracy, like our Earth, our beloved Earth, right, our challenges of today, and think of how not how do I solve this problem, but how do we move into true inquiry, into that place of wonder, and come from that place of wanting to affirm life, to give life to something, not to destroy something. How do we bring that into this constant drumbeat of our divisiveness? Yes, we need to acknowledge, but are we acknowledging that more and more and more into a solidified existence that is making it harder and harder to break through those walls? That's the power of our language. How do we hold that need to recognize and speak of without actually making it more of a truth than it is? Making it more intractable than it is. Dogen said, when a bird leaves the air, because the air is its element, and that's where it flies freely, when it leaves the air, it dies at once. When a fish swims in the ocean, because the ocean is its element, it is its world, it's its Buddha field, when it leaves that element, it dies at once. What is our element? What is the element that we cannot leave, or else we begin to die at once? We call it our true self, our self nature. When we turn away from that, we begin to die at once. And the signs of that is what we call dukkha, all the many signs. And it is not a surprise, it's not a mystery, really. Although we cannot understand it, but we can understand it. And so then Dogen says, know then that water is life. Know that air is life. Know that your self-nature is life. The path is your life. The bird is life and the fish is life. Life is the bird, life is the fish. Life is you and you are life. That's a place we can meet. That's a truth that is true for every single person. So what is the language of that? How do we speak about that in 100,000 different tongues? How do we remember that we are one body? Well, let's find out. Shall we? Is that something worthy of our precious life to dedicate ourselves to? Let's find out. And not by waiting.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the Monastery Store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.